reasons we're unique human beings. Stutter is functional as a theory, Durkheim believed in.
Dear someone, I write this here for you. It's a gift from the soul that completes you. Dear someone, couldn't have written nothing realer. Live from the heart and soul, signed, still delivered. Dear someone, look at the world that we live in. The core cries when we heard the earth as it's spinning. Dear someone, life moves forward, you can't pause. Rewind or fast forward, be wise, it's really
almost
yours.
Forgot that what I write is sacred. The scribes is moving up with times, it's rough. Concrete elevation, laundry bigger, for life is spacious. The pen is mightier than the sword, delivers peace when wars are waged. Separate states, different nations, over monetary basics that are thrown in clubs on a nightly basis. I'm not alone in this life of mine. Probably a kid in Palestine, dodging landmines and jotting rhymes for documentation. My 5-4 mind, more like his brain is racing. Swerving, drift through hardships, really driving patient. Defined was solidified through margin pages, spitting lines and open mics for mass confirmation. From 12-year-olds in dirty rooms to vinyl-filled basements, this urban language is therapy during times of anguish. A concrete jungle, still I stay humble in the days when lions roam uncaged. Tarzan up the pavement, rhymes on these pages go farther than entertainment. Heart full of rage, but the outcome is pure amazing.
Dear someone, I write this here for you. It's a gift from the soul that completes you. Dear someone, couldn't have written nothing. Gorilla, live from the heart and soul, sound still delivered. Dear someone, look at the world that we live in. The core cries when we hurt the earth as it's spinning. Dear someone, life moves forward, you can't pause. Rewind or fast forward, be wise, it's still yours. Be wise, it's still yours.
WBAI is a listener-sponsored radio station that runs on support and annual funding. However, it has recently not obtained the critical funding it needs from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. On Sunday, August 2nd at 1 p.m., the WBAI Community Advisory Board will hold a teach-in. This will take place at the Atrium in Lower Manhattan at 60 Wall Street and will be a time for WBAI to explain why it has not received the staggering amount of nearly $700,000. We are a proud voice of the 99%, but it's difficult to spread their message without the proper resources. Once again, the date is Sunday, August 2nd, 1 p.m. at the Atrium in Lower Manhattan at 60 Wall Street. Please lend us your ears and attention while we work toward a solution.
Oh no, it's my sweetie's birthday tomorrow and I forgot to buy a present. It's 3 in the morning. Nothing's open. What am I going to do?
I have an idea.
Tickets. I'll buy tickets to a fantastic event. I can do it anytime, even now, 3 in the morning, by going to the WBAI donation website, give2wbai.org. There's a great selection of plays, events, discussions, concerts, movies. I'll definitely find something. All I have to do is click on the header that says tickets. I'm saved! Happy birthday, sweetie! That's give2wbai.org and click on the header that says tickets.
One of the planets in our solar system.
Is it a planet?
Is it not a planet?
You Earthlings,
residents of Colorado Springs, Colorado Springulians, you listen to the scientific facts laid out in the sun. You decide for yourself. Is it a planet? Or is it a planet? In Arizona, at the turn of the 20th century, astromathematician Percival Lowell was searching for what he called Planet X, because he knew deep down in his soul that an unseen gravitational presence meant a new planet spinning in the air, joining the other eight already known, circling our sun up there. But Percival Lowell died in 1916, his theory still only a theory, till 1930, when Clyde Tombaugh, in his scientific query, discovered Planet X, 3.7 billion miles from our sun, a smallish ball of frozen rock, methane and nitrogen. It joined Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. Our solar system's newest neighbor, two-thirds the size of our moon. A tiny, barely visible speck of coal, minus 440 below. Not exactly paradise. They named the planet
Pluto!
Hey! Phew, you're paying attention. That same year, 1930, Walt Disney debuted his own Pluto as well. But a cartoon dog with the very same name as the CEO of hell. Now that was not your normal Disney style. Most thought he was riding the coattails of Plutomania sweeping the land, not unlike our modern love for manatees and whales. For the next 5 decades, mysterious Pluto kept invading our minds. As late as 1978, its own moon Charon was seen for the very first time. But now, telescopes and satellites and computer calculations say that Pluto may not be a planet at all, creating great consternation. Some scientists say that Pluto is a trans-Neptunian interloper swept away by an unknown force, or a remnant of a wayward comet somehow sucked off course. Others say that Pluto is an asteroid in the sun's gravitational pull. But if you had asked Clyde Tombaugh, he would have told you that's all bull. I get hundreds of letters from kids every year, he says. Is Pluto the planet they love? It's not Pluto the comet, it's not Pluto the asteroid they wonder about above. And at the International Astronomical Union Working Group for Planetary System Nomenclature, that is a real club, they too say Pluto is a planet, reinforcing Clyde Tombaugh's view of nature. Norwegian Carrie Eksnes, professor at the Theoretical Astrophysics Institute, he too says Pluto is a planet and a significant one to boot. But at the University of Colorado, astronomer Larry Esposito, don't applaud this man. He says if Pluto were discovered today, it would not be a planet. End of discussion, finito. He says that Pluto is definitely not spun off from solar matter like the other eight planets we know. By every scientific measurement we have, is Pluto a planet? No. And now 20 astronomy textbooks refer to Pluto as less than a planet. I guess if Pluto showed up at a planet convention, the bouncer would be forced to ban it. Christopher's looking down on this and he says, Pluto,
can relate. When I was Demona from sainthood, I gotta tell you, little buddy, it didn't feel real great. And Scorpios look up in despair because Pluto rules their sign. Is now reading their daily horoscope just a futile waste of time? It takes 248 Earth years for Pluto to circle our sun. It's tiny and it's cold, but of all heavenly bodies, it was Clyde Tombaugh's favorite one. Till he was 91, he worked every day in Las Cruces, New Mexico, determined to maintain the planetary status of his beloved Pluto. But how are we going to deal with it? If science comes up with the proof that Pluto is never a planet, how do we handle this truth? As the PhDs all disagree, we don't know yet who's wrong or who's right. But wherever you are and whatever you are, Pluto, we know you're up there tonight. And in the year 2016, you're going to see the New Horizons Express. Fly by and take pictures of your way cool surface to send to your webpage address. http://doxxx.colorado.edu/pluto-home.html. You've got your own webpage for little guy. You sure make quite a splash. Yes, at the turn of the 20th century, astro-mathematician Percival Lowell, in his quest for Planet X, started this ball to roll. But at the start of the 21st century, we think he may have been a little off base. So we look at the sky and wonder what new surprises await us in outer space.
And I want to welcome you. You're listening to WBAI in New York City. This is Heart of Mind, Earth at Midnight. I'm Catherine Davis, and I'm joined by my co-host, Paulette Spencer. Hello, Paulette.
Hello, Catherine.
And today we're going to have a very earthian kind of show, I would say.
Yes.
And we're going to be looking at what's happening in our planet, on our planet, with regard to what's happening in space. So it's going to be a lot of fun. And I hope all of you who are listening right now will stay tuned in. That was a really special piece of music we just heard, Planet X by Christine Lavin. And we heard the theme, opening theme for Earth at Midnight, Earth by Michelle Indiacello. And we're going to go to another piece of music, and then we will be right back.
And finally, with a question mark, on March 30th, 1930, if I am not mistaken, Dr. Tombaugh, our guest tonight, observed the planet Pluto, whose position had been predicted by the computations of Percival Lowell. With that, it is with great pride and pleasure that I introduce my co-host for this segment, Steve Cates, who produces the Skywatch report of observational astronomy that we hear regularly on Earthwatch, and live from New Mexico, Dr. Clyde Tombaugh. Good morning, gentlemen. Are we all together?
Yes, good morning.
Hello, yes.
Good morning, Steve, and good morning, Dr. Tombaugh.
Good morning, Robert.
I hardly know where to begin, Dr. Tombaugh. Why don't you tell us how it was that you came to first perceive this currently outermost planet?
All right. I came to the Lowell Observatory in 1929 at the invitation of the director, whom I had sent drawings of Mars and Jupiter, made my homemade telescope. And then I found out I was assigned to take photographs with a new photographic telescope, a 13-inch triple lens. And after about a year of searching, I found the planet. I was going through the entire zodiac, photographing the zodiac, and taking sea plates of each region, one for confirmation purposes. And so on the plates I took were in January 1930. And of course, when I took the plates, I did not know that Pluto was recorded on them. I ran onto the images. The discovery was actually the 18th of February, about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And then the discovery was announced to the world on the 13th of March, 1930.
Yes. About 4 o'clock in the afternoon on the 18th of February, 1930, is when you realized that you had captured Pluto.
Yes, that was the actual discovery moment.
Now, you described yourself as having come to the observatory, having built your own telescopes prior to that. Had you had a long interest prior in astronomy?
Yes, I started studying astronomy when I was 12 years old, back in 1918.
Good morning, Dr. Tombaugh. This is Steve Cates here, the co-host, as Robert Knight mentioned before. It's a shame that I had missed you on our recent journey to New Mexico, as we promoted here on the Earthwatch program a few weeks ago that we would hopefully have an encounter in person with you. And I know you and I have met a number of times in your observatory and location in your offices at New Mexico State. But one of the major quests that I was trying to find an answer to, and I'm sure all of our listeners would like to be informed by the expert yourself on the particular object, we've come to understand recently some news reports indicating some recent excitement about Pluto not actually being a planet, but an errant asteroid. I was wondering if you'd be kind enough to elaborate more on that for all of our listeners now.
This was a story put out from Houston, from the planetarium, and it was unauthorized and really was inappropriate. And it has been refuted by many other astronomers.
Apparently, according to the IRAS infrared astronomy satellite, they have imaged the object, which we, of course, will say planet Pluto, of course.
And good evening.
Recent news reports. I have one here in front of me.
And good evening. Again, this is Paulette Spencer, and I'm here on A Peace of Mind, Earth at Midnight with Kathy Davis. And as you've probably been listening closely, you realize that our topic this evening is the most recent events concerning the dwarf planet Pluto and the flyby expeditions by the New Horizons spaceship. And we're very happy to have with us Mr. Steve Cates, who you just heard interviewing Dr. Clyde Tombaugh, the discoverer of the then planet Pluto. Steve, we're very happy to have you with us tonight.
Well, Paulette, I want to thank you so much, and Kathy, for having me here. And amazing how time flies, isn't it? Well, 28 years ago, that interview done with none other than Robert Knight and myself with the great one, Dr. Tombaugh. What a wonderful celebration, and what a wonderful celebration of Robert's life as we talk about all of these great people and great subjects.
Very true. I'm so glad that you're able to join us tonight.
Thank you. We're here in Phoenix, Arizona, where we're still out here with a group of people. Paulette, we were doing an astronomy class tonight, talking about how to use your telescope. And the main object of interest, of course, is the news reports coming back from the dwarf planet itself, Pluto. What an amazing mission. Isn't that incredible?
Oh, yes. And I wanted to get your take on the impact of such an event. I guess that's a really broad question, but...
Yes. Well, Paulette, I start off with going back to the days meeting Dr. Tombaugh in New Mexico. I had him as a professor, just so the audience knows, at New Mexico State. And here's a young 20-ish-year-old student, myself, going into a class very nervous on astronomy and science. And even at that young age, like many people out there, I really wasn't totally certain of the career path that I wanted to pursue. But listening to this man, basically a farmer, a boy farmer from Kansas who had the passion of wanting to learn about the unknowns, he came to the Lowell Observatory in the 1920s and basically was almost, I hate to use the word, begging for the job because he wanted to work and help discover that planet X that Percival Lowell thought was well beyond that of Neptune. And so the story goes, he gets hired by the director there, a gentleman named V.M. Slipher, and all goes down in the history books when on February the 18th, 1930, right here in our state of Arizona and for all the United States, the first major object, then called a planet, and we could dispute that, whether a dwarf than a planet, the big differences in why Pluto in many people's minds should be a planet, but that's amazing. An American discoverer of a major object in space with little technology of the time, Paulette. The technology of that time was obviously nothing like today, so it's amazing that he even found it, don't you think? It's just incredible.
Absolutely, and hopefully a little bit later, or maybe you can elaborate on what some of the points were that he made in terms of his ability to locate the planet.
Well, it's a long story, and compressing it into the time here live on WBAI, he spent years taking photographic plates. These were large plates, the size, literally like bigger than dinner plates, you know, rectangular plates, photographic plates. When in those days, we had nothing like we have with digital technology like today, where we, of course, can see so many wonderful images instantaneously when we go ahead and look in the nighttime sky now digitally. He had to go and spend the whole night photographing the sky and then taking the time to go ahead and having those plates developed in the daytime. So I don't think Clyde got much sleep in those days, but after so many years, what did he do? He then discovered this little tiny object by using what's called the blink comparator. They took a picture over here on the left, and then maybe a week later they took this picture on the right, and then that whole thing turns out to be thousands and thousands of hours of using this basic crude technology, and he announces to the world the first major object discovered beyond that of Neptune. Remember, Neptune was discovered in September of 1846, so that long period between 1846 and 1930, it's amazing. And now talking about the spacecraft, that to me is just so surreal, don't you think, of what we're hearing in the last 24 hours with the New Horizons.
Certainly, and I understand it's powered by plutonium, ironically enough. And it's actually, I think it's going to have enough energy to last until roughly 2030, I think they said.
Yes, and that was very controversial back even before this particular spacecraft. You know, there were lots of protests. And I think Robert and I, during the time doing the show with Robert for what, over 30 years,
yes,
this fixture, again, I'm so honored to have known Robert. And again, I want to pass on my condolences to you, your family, and to the audience.
Thank you.
About the sudden passing of Robert. But back then, before this particular spacecraft, there was a lot of controversy about the Cassini space probe that was using this type of plutonium, the nuclear fuel, and many people protested because they thought, well, what happens if the spacecraft explodes on the launch pad? Mm-hmm. Well, luckily it didn't, but this particular spacecraft uses plutonium-ish pellets. They have, I think, and I don't know this, I'm not looking at the internet or don't know this actually for sure, but probably, I think, over 12 pounds, maybe even more, of these plutonium pellets. So the point is, this spacecraft will live on for so long, it'll outlive our earthly lives here on this Earth. But what's happening is, the spacecraft is then going to be moving out toward objects that are still out in the Kuiper Belt. The good folks at NASA and at JPL haven't really decided yet where they're going to send this craft. So there are other objects that it could potentially be viewing. Well, we're so excited, Paul, that, like, the whole world. I mean, have you seen some of those images come through today?
I have.
Isn't that incredible?
I have, and that's how I thought of interviewing you. I looked at the images, and I remembered listening to your interview with Dr. Tom Bao, and you came immediately to mind. And
well, thank you for thinking of me. I mean, just to catch up with the audience, you know, this whole thing has turned into the Dr. Sky role for me on a lot of networks around the country. I mean, I do a lot. I'm proud to be part of Coast to Coast AM at night, you know, with George Norrie, and here doing television and around the country. But not so much about me. It's about Paulette. As you know, the fascination, whether we're young children or whether we're senior citizens or somewhere in between, I mean, this one doesn't have to do with politics. I mean, it's just about exploration into the vast unknown. And that's what I think makes this thing so popular. Because I think if there's any rallying point, don't you think, for the people on this planet to come together, hopefully it's about things that we can learn about the wonders of the nature beyond the planet Earth. I think it's a well-formulated statement, don't you think?
Completely. Completely.
I also agree with that. Yeah.
It serves as a unifying force.
Absolutely. Mm. So looking at this particular mission, the New Horizons, I mean, this is just so amazing. It's described by people. I did some other interviews today. And I want people to do this at their convenience. Go to drsky.com, just drsky.com. If you go along the left side of our website, you'll see something called Teen Talk Network. It was started by myself and another person who has passion for space. And again, we do this in the pro bono mode, not to raise money, but to let people learn, mostly kids at school. We have well over 500 interviews in there. And the one I did today was with one of the JPL and scientists, of course, with one of the mission instruments on board. It's the UV spectrometer. And this particular interview with Dr. Michael Davis, he talks about how he was there on the floor of JPL putting together this in a clean room, actually, and, you know, putting these different components together on something that's leaving the solar system, moving on billions of miles away. And what's so cool is that the ashes of Dr. Tom Bao, there's a small part of that spacecraft on the upper left side where some of his earthly ashes are interned on the spacecraft. What better tribute could you have to a person who loved the science of astronomy,
truly
contributed to making a discovery? So we just live in so many fascinating times for science. So people can go to that series of interviews if they want to learn much more about these in-depth interviews with people of science.
Yeah, I actually saw a picture of the container that has his ashes in it.
Yes, it's just amazing how they did this. And also, we, meaning myself and about 400,000 other people, and I haven't come across anybody else, but we all said, you know what, we support these planetary missions. And we sent our name to JPL NASA, and I thought this was a joke at first, and then my friend said, no, this is real. So they collected 400 and some thousand names. I mean, I'm happy to be part of that. And a lot of other people like ourselves that love science. So our names are in spirit. They're on board that spacecraft for all time to come. Hmm. And that's a great and powerful statement, that if 400,000 people here on the Earth thought this was cool, now I'm sure if they could do it, you know, a little late to get it on board the spacecraft, but with the popularity of this mission, it just knocks it out of the ballpark.
Sure, right. That unifying force, that we are all one planet.
We sure the heck are, and like they say, why can't we all just get along? And I think it's so well said by people that I've met in my lifetime. When Dr. Sagan was at Cornell, I had the opportunity in college to visit with him. He said to me this, he said, Steve, he said, tell people that we are the pale blue dot. And I think he said it so well, that in this giant universe, and I'm standing out here under the starry sky of Arizona, a little bit, maybe 40 miles to the west of Phoenix in this monsoonish night. If I look to the east, ladies, I see the big power of nature with the lightning on the horizon. But over here to the west, I see a clear sky. But what better way and what better tribute than to stare up into the sky doing this with you fine ladies on WPAI, commemorating not only the mission of New Horizons, and also commemorating our time spending with Robert Knight discussing the Earthwatch story, as he did so well. I remember, Paul, that he so appropriately identified himself as the Astrogator. I love that.
Yeah.
You know, there's an Astrogator. And people said to me, tell me about an Astrogator. I said, well, think about it. It's someone who's standing on the starship, and that's the Earth. And he's navigating us through time and space. So, you know, that's Robert Knight. He's still out there as the Astrogator.
Yes, he is.
Absolutely.
I'm sure he is, and staring with you at the stars, I'm sure.
And all of us, most definitely.
I have a
very cool.
This is
sure.
It all is very cool. I have a question about Pluto. Do you think it will be given back its full planetary status after this?
You know, that's an interesting question, Paulette, and here's my quick cut-to-the-chase answer. I think it will, because talking with Dr. Stern, Alan Stern of the Southwest Research Institute over the years, he was always, and I can't put words in his mouth, but of the interviews that we did with him, he was always a proponent of saying, let's not be so quick in taking Pluto and demoting it. But I think, Paulette, if you look at that and analyze all this data coming in, I mean, we see an object that is about 1,485 miles across. That's like if you had this object, let's say, from New York City on one end, it would maybe be all the way to Kansas City.
Mm-hmm.
If you looked at it in relative size to the moon, it obviously is a bit smaller than the Earth's moon, but here's the part that makes me want to think that it's really a planet. It has an atmosphere. It has five attendant moons. It has Charon, the largest of its moons, which, by the way, was discovered here in Arizona in 1978 by the astronomer James Christie. And if you go and look, and not just to be sympathetic to Dr. Tombaugh or, oh, wow, look at Pluto, you know, it's in the news, I think it will come back, and I think we rightfully should just put it back in its place, because for 75-ish years it was a planet. And the argument that could be raised here is if you really, really look at the literal definition of a planet, why then was Pluto removed? And one of the objections that some scientists say is that it doesn't clear its path as it moves around the sun. Well, if I'm scratching my head thinking about that, saying, well, what perturbs it? Well, what's in the planetary path of Pluto? I don't see anything, do you? I mean, and I don't quite understand that totally. I think the problem is with these definitions. So I'm hoping that Pluto returns its planetary status, or gets its planetary status, and that the other objects that are out there, I mean, there are lots of other large objects out there, all the way out to the Sedna and the Eris, and these objects are now pretty much confirmed that they're smaller than Pluto. So if Pluto has lost its status, it's got five moons, it does, in my mind, kind of move around the sun in its own orbit, albeit a highly inclined orbit, 17 degrees. Paula and Kathy, I just hope we get it back. Why not, right?
Exactly. I think it deserves planetary status for sure.
Give us our Pluto back. and you know, not to be the perpetual promoter here on the show here, but I just wanted people to know that in dedication to Robert and in dedication to this entire subject, 10 years ago, when they changed it, I was a little upset, to put it mildly. So keeppluto.alive.com has some of the interviews that you just played and a few other things. And people can go to drsky.com to learn a lot about what we're doing out there. Mm-hmm. And really, it's just an honor to be with you ladies to talk about the legacy of not only Robert Knight, but the planet Pluto, the dwarf planet, or something in between. And wow, I was told by the people at the Southwest Research Institute, get set, folks, the next few days, you're going to really see some amazing pictures that, for once, hopefully can make us learn or have us learn more about Pluto as this amazing object, the god of the underworld. And imagine that, 4.5 hours to go one way. So if you ladies were over on Pluto and I'm here, imagine we're communicating now in near real time. But it would take 4.5 hours for you just to hear what I'm saying, and I would take another 4.5 hours to hear back what you're saying, so a 9-hour transmission time.
Wow.
That's far. That's amazing.
That is amazing. And I think it's also amazing how far the spaceship had to travel. Understand that it took 9 years and 3 billion miles.
It's incredible. And here's another factoid of this that really just blew my mind. If you think about this spacecraft being launched in January of 2006, It is not alleged, but it's a fact, that it actually left the Earth's orbit and went from the Earth to the moon, ready for this, folks, in 9 hours, not like the Apollo spacecraft took, let's say, 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
So this took 9 hours to get from the Earth to the moon.
Wow.
And then bolted about 1 million miles per day to go on a 3.5 billion mile journey. So if we do the math, even at this early hour for our New York and metro area audience, think about this, folks. If light travels 11 million miles a minute and it takes 4.5 hours to get out there at the speed of light, just think. Look at these distances. If you take 1 million, so 1 billion is 1,000 million, and then 1 trillion would be 1,000 billion, but 3.5 billion miles out. So what is that? 3,500 million miles out into the solar system. And that's nowhere near, ladies, even the nearest star. So, wow, what a universe.
Oh, yeah.
It's pretty amazing. This is Catherine. I have kind of an interesting question, well, at least interesting to me. Traveling at that speed, is it like going into a different time frame, or is it like traveling into the past or the future?
No, not quite. I mean, it's still, even though we're talking it up as being rocket speed, and that obviously is a bad choice of words. It's just incredible speed, 35, 36,000 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
It even pales by comparison to what light speed is. But for humans on the Earth to achieve that since 1903, with the Wright brothers making a first flight less than the distance of the wing of the 747, to now moving forward to building spacecraft that are zooming through the solar system, it's still fast, but certainly we need better technology. And now, I rarely get on political, soapboxes, but I think it's very simple. I think in this country and other countries around the world, we really need to cooperate to build together better ways to get out of the Earth environment. Because think of this, the space station's only some 260 miles above the Earth. From where I am in Phoenix, that's like taking a ruler and going all the way up to Las Vegas and then turning it straight up in the sky. That's really not out in space. That's just low Earth orbit. And Dr. Hawking, Stephen Hawking has said that we need to get off this planet. And what a shame if we, simply can't all get along on this planet. And they were a tiny little speck. But the point is, we need bigger rockets, faster technologies that get us out there, because the next goal is to colonize Mars. And according to some reliable people, and you both know this, maybe within 20 years, we're going to have people on the surface of Mars, albeit a hard journey, 9 months one way at conventional rocket speeds. But you have to salute people like Elon Musk at SpaceX, even though they've had a few, bumps in the road with the last rocket explosion.
Mm-hmm.
He's, in my mind, he's a pioneer. And we need more pioneers to help build us and take the politics out of it, don't you think?
Yeah, take the politics out of it, and we can take the money out of the war machine and put it into the space exploration, I think would be
a much better use of
resources.
Sure. We need to move forward.
Yeah.
But I think as I look at my phone here, and I hate to cut you ladies short, but I'm standing here on extended life support with a battery that looks like it's shut. 3%. And believe me, I'd love to stay with you fine folks forever here, but unfortunately, it's better to say that before I just drop out of the universe here and sound like I've just been disconnected on the New Horizons mission.
All right. Well, that means we'll just have to have you come back again.
Well, thank you. It's an honor.
And speak on some of these things for our listeners.
Well, thank you both, ladies. And I appreciate it, Kathy, and I appreciate it, Paulette, for having me here on WBAI. It's always been a part of my life doing the show with Robert Knight, our astrogator, and he continues, I'm sure, to look down upon us. And I'm sure he's smiling from one ear to the other about the great success this particular mission. So thank you so much. And
thank you.
Godspeed to the New Horizon on WBAI here. Thank you so much.
We'll be in touch. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Take care.
Have a great morning.
You
bye-bye.
Too. Thank you.
On the As the bombshells of my daily fears explode, I try to trace them to my youth. And then you had to bring up reincarnation over a couple of beers the other night. And now I'm serving time for mistakes made by another in another lifetime. How long till my soul gets it right? Can any human being ever reach that kind of light? I call on the resting soul of Galileo, king of night vision, king of insight. And then I think about my
to the IRAS infrared astronomy satellite, they have imaged the object, which we, of course, will say planet Pluto, of course, and proudly. They indicate in a recent news report, I have one here in front of me, a wire service report here from Lee Dai, actually a transcript from the Los Angeles Times dated May 14th, that the assumed diameter now of the planet Pluto is about 1,370 miles. Wondering how accurate that information is, as we're asking that question now.
What is that figure again, you said?
They were saying 1,370 miles, making it an exceptionally small object in the solar system.
1,370 miles. Well, that seems to be the result of their recent measurements now that the satellite of Pluto is passing in front of and behind Pluto. And by noting the manner of dimming and the duration, they come up with that size. Which is quite small, smaller than we thought.
The relative sizes of Pluto and its satellite appear to be somewhat comparable, at least in comparison to the relative sizes of Earth and Moon. Is that correct?
The satellite of Pluto is fairly much closer to the size of Pluto itself.
What is it like on the surface of Pluto?
Well, this can, of course, can only be theoretical. We know that it must be very cold there, and cold enough for, on its average distance from the sun, for methane to be frozen as a snow upon the surface. Now it has come inside the critical limit, where I believe it is beginning to what we call sublimate, forming a methane atmosphere. This is only a temporary thing during its perihelion.
Pluto is, interestingly enough, at this time, not the outermost planet of the solar system.
Yes, but this lasts only 19 years.
Its orbit actually comes closer to the sun than that of Neptune, its innermost neighbor.
Yes, but it's only a very small part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Most of it goes far beyond Neptune.
One other comment and then a question, Dr. Tombaugh. As the co-host here, as Robert mentioned, on the Earthwatch program, I do a small segment as often as once a week called Skywatch Network. And the main theme, as Robert and I have been pursuing over the years, has been to identify principal objects in astronomy for listeners who may or may not have a lot of experience in the science, but more so, viewing objects in our skies, in our light-polluted skies. Now, after seeing the beautiful skies of New Mexico and the opportunity we had last year to report live on the air here on WBAI from southern New Mexico in viewing Comet Halley, the question I would have is, what can the average person do about the phenomenon which is growing called light pollution? Obviously, here in the New York metro area, there are lots of things we can see, but what, in your opinion, can the average person do about light pollution?
Well, there's not much you can do. Of course, some cities now are making provision to put shades on them to reflect the light back towards the ground and not into the sky, which, of course, means a saving of electrical current and also reduces the light pollution. This is a fairly recent movement on part of several cities.
I always ask this question when visiting with you over the course of about 5 to 10 years on occasional visits to my family out in Las Cruces also, but it seems phenomenal, the answer that you have to this question each time. What, again, is the potential for the 10th and thus 11th and beyond planets in our solar system? And I know as we move on with new interstellar probes and various projects like the Hubble Space Telescope, there seems to be a wealth of information to be released and discoveries to be made. But in your opinion, as we approach the morning hours here on the eastern coast of the United States, what is the potential for the next series of planets beyond that of Pluto?
Well, I doubt whether they can be found because the angry area of the sky is just as great as ever. And the big problem is you have to see so many millions of stars. And you have to check and see which one, if any of them, shift position. This requires photography plates taken a few nights apart, you see. And so with the space telescope, it has a very small field and is unsuited for making this kind of a survey. Field is not big enough.
I've heard
that they could record faint objects, but you never could cover the sky adequately to make a systematic search.
Excuse me, I've heard speculation that there is possibly an object maybe 5 or 10 times the size of, say, the planet Jupiter that could potentially lurk out somewhere halfway, say, between the sun and Alpha Centauri. And I was wondering if indeed that's just speculation or if there's any more information that we might be able to learn this morning about that.
Well, I think that's just speculation. Of course, we have no way, no hope of ever seeing it. That'd be too dim.
Dr. Tombaugh, I can't resist this question of possible alternate history. Do you remember any of the other names that were being kicked around at the observatory before it settled on Pluto?
Cronus is also considered.
Cronus, that's an alternate for Saturn, isn't it?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And what happened to you personally, your life and career, activities, notoriety, following the discovery?
Well, I went on, of course, the Pluto appeared to be about 10 times too faint to be Lowell's Planet X.
Well, there was some uneasiness that maybe what I'd found was not, that the planet X was yet to be found. So they had me go on, continue the search for 13 more years. Over 65% of the whole sky and nothing more showed up. And so I would have to say that planet X does not exist.
Well, I think we have to congratulate you on a thorough job, and I imagine that a discovery of that nature represents a most remarkable professional culmination. Is that right?
Yes. I sat at that blink comparator for a total of 7,000 hours, and I saw individually through the eyepiece of the instrument 19 million star images.
Now, that must be one of the most incredible tasks yet undertaken, just the patience to persevere through examining plates like that. And I guess to explain this to our listeners right now, these are not the standard positives, or are they negatives? These are actually negatives that you're comparing?
Original plates are negatives.
Correct.
Because when you copy a plate back, the defects are not so obvious. So we prefer to use the negatives, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And even then, I had several thousand false planet suspects. And I had those had to be checked by the third plate.
Tom Bell, this is Robert Knight here with Steve Cates, and again, our gratitude for this appearance of yours is incompletely expressible, and we'll leave you with the last word as to what the perceptive member of the space environment might be watching in the coming days and years.
Well, speaking of you, trying to find Pluto, I think you need an instrument bigger than an 8-inch.
Okay.
Mars 11, even with the most perfect sky conditions, I would say a 10-inch or a 12-inch is needed to really see it.
Very good. We'll see if we can somehow gather a 10-inch or bigger telescope to...
Not moonlight and without city lights.
Well, that's, again, one of the problems that we suffer from, but our audience out there certainly has been able to find principal planets. We want to continue that tradition. Again, many thanks for appearing here this morning to enlighten all of our listeners on your fantastic discovery. Again, a major planet in the solar system, in addition to the other eight that we have, now the ninth planet, the planet Pluto.
And knowing that it's prime time out there in New Mexico, observationally speaking, we'll leave you, Dr. Tom Bau, to return to the sky.
Okay, thank you.
And thank you for joining us here on Earthwatch. This is Earthwatch on WBAI in New York.
Freedom still rings. Sorrow to me, but does it ring to know the bell of freedom still rings? The hammer for justice still pounds. The hammer for justice still pounds. Heavy is the beating sound of the hammer for justice that pounds. upon us with a frown, to know that millions of babies still starve. Millions of babies still starve. We can't have the biggest heart if millions of babies still starve. And the innocent ones still die. The innocent ones still die. We can't value life too high if the innocent ones still die. When will the world stop enlisting? When will we all stop and see? When will we find what we've been missing? That the man in the moon must have found. 'Cause he looks upon us with a frown. Light of truth we won't let shine. Light of truth we won't let shine. Tell me, has the world gone blind? The light of truth we won't let shine. As long as there's life, there's still a day. As long as there's life, there's still a day. And I know that we can find our way. For as long as there's life, there's still a day.
Welcome. You're listening to WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. I'm Catherine Davis in studio with
Paulette Spencer.
Yes. So, Paulette, have you ever gone skinny dipping in the moonlight?
No, but I wish I had. They make it sound so good.
I think that that's something that I'm going to have to do before my days are done, is to go skinny dipping in the moonlight. Hopefully in a nice, warm, tropical waters.
Yes.
Where it would be very comfortable and safe. So it's interesting, that song, Skinny Dipping in the Moonlight, and the context of our program this evening, and we were talking about, you know, the development of space exploration, the changing attitudes towards this particular little planet called Pluto.
Yes.
And in general, changing attitudes in terms of understanding the existence as it is around us. I know earlier on you and I were talking about this thing called scalar energy. And scalar energy is just a measurement of the energy that exists in space, which you were saying is the same as dark matter.
Right.
Yeah, because there's really no area that isn't teeming with energy. And one of the ways that a lot of really revolutionary scientists are tapping into this knowledge is creating what they call free energy, zero point energy or free energy, that allows you to tap into that energy and use it as a motivating force for vehicles, for healing. And it's something that's used naturally all the time, but you have to recognize it. And I've been doing some research on this, and I believe that we'll be covering this next week on the program, because it's just so fascinating to understand that how once you begin to recognize the patterning of scalar energy, you see how it's replicated in all of the growth cycles on the planet, and how it's replicated in cycles of all kind, including cosmic cycles.
Wow.
So it's a really interesting matter of discussion, because as it happens, there is a lot of research going into scalar energy, and unfortunately a lot of that research is being done by the military-industrial complex. So they're learning to use this powerful force to access it for weaponry, or to access it for energy for planes and for all kinds of vehicles, because it really does provide an energy boost. And what's really interesting, I have been looking at a film, and what it does is it shows how in the natural world, animals, insects, birds are actually using the scalar energy as a motivating factor. And it's how, you know, it shows the air patterns around the wings of a dragonfly, and you can see how it's actually creating or tapping into this energy to be able to do what it does. So bees use it, because a bee's wings are not actually powerful enough to lift the weight of a bee, and they're actually tapping into this energy as a force that's allowing them to move the way they move. And so it's really interesting, you know, fish like salmon who can swim upstream are actually tapping into this scalar energy force. So what it does is it gives you different kinds of mobility and different kinds of power in terms of movement. Flocks of birds use it when they travel those huge distances. They're using scalar energy forces, which is the underlying force that's already in the cosmos, in the Earth atmosphere, and in with every living thing. It's part of the energy that makes up our own life force energy. And as we learn to use it, we can be more empowered in healing so that we don't depend as much on chemical-based remedies and surgeries and stuff like that. We can depend more on this naturally existing invisible energy force that is underlying existence. It's interesting because it's not just an energy force. There's a real intelligence to it and a consciousness to it, and we can tap into it. So it's a very fascinating science, and it's not new, but it's been very much suppressed. And Nikola Tesla was using scalar energy when he built his towers that were creating free energy that would be able to travel through space. And so the energy, the information has been around for a long time, but it's been suppressed as far as the public is concerned, because we've been pretty much tied down into, you know, fossil fuels and into this kind of economic cycle where we don't get the most advanced technology because it's not easily profited from. And so, but the military does have it and they're using it. And so it's a very interesting thing, because it's time for this information really to be brought into the public, so that we can have those same access to those, to that same free energy, scalar energy, and to the healing potential of it. So it's interesting.
Certainly. And I, as you speak about its application in the medical world, I recall hearing a physician once describing her role. She said, she doesn't heal you, she just removes the impediments so that your body can heal itself.
Mm-hmm. Well, I really like that description. I guess for myself, it would depend on what that meant. Mm-hmm. So if that means surgery, if that means, you know, depending. So I like that philosophy. But I think that we can begin to look at more advanced technology as the mechanism. Mm. So, for instance, there's the scalar energy is a vibrational technology, and or it can be used as a vibrational technology. And there's a lot of that happening now. It's like, you know, you can use sound to, like, a lot of times when a person has you know, stones in their bladder or something, they use sound to break it up. Mm-hmm. And it's really a variation of that. And it's much more refined. And a lot of what people do when they're doing hands-on healing is they're actually tapping into those, that scalar energy wave. So when a person is doing hands-on healing, that's this very deep vibration of heat, sound, and energy is flowing through the person into the person's body that's being healed. So as a human being, we're really like resonators. We're like tuning forks. So one person who is healthy can be the tuning fork to another person who's ill, and they're just basically gathering the energy from the field, the unified field, and helping to deliver the energy to a person who doesn't have that natural access because of their illness. So it's a way of transforming and changing a person's health in a way that's very natural and basically gains access to what's available right in our environment. Mm. So it's a really interesting thing. And so I think once this science becomes more widely known and understood by the medical professions, they'll be really excited about using it, I think. Once we can get the money out of it. You know, the whole part of the problems with medicine is the monetary investment. It's like with the healthcare bill. All of the special interests got their hands into it, and it became something that would promote the use of drugs and surgery and, in, you know, healthcare and health industry. So a lot of the healthcare bill is about supporting the healthcare industry, and it's not about really providing healthcare. And because there's all this money in it, and that's where a lot of these discoveries are suppressed, or anything that works is suppressed. Any scientist who comes out with something new, they end up with lots of legal problems. And a lot of the early complementary and alternative practitioners ended up with legal problems because of it becomes a challenge to the corporatocracy or the money monopoly in medicine.
Yes, and I think the last time we spoke, we talked about this Trans-Pacific Pact, the TPP.
Mm-hmm. Which did pass, finally, I understand.
And unfortunately, when it comes to pharmaceuticals, people in other countries, I guess the countries within this pact, suffer, because part of it is giving the corporations much more leverage than local governments,
mm-hmm.
and local governments' abilities to create generic drugs that are more affordable to those populations. So that's mm-hmm. exactly what you're saying.
Yeah, and also it's very much like the, I'm trying to remember the name of this other law that they have in many European countries that denies people access to natural supplements and forces them to go to a doctor and get a prescription to get a vitamin. And so there are all of these laws that have been created that are designed to control people's behavior, control their access, limit information, and create profit for a few of these multinational corporations that are basically interested in they're actually interested in exploiting humanity rather than actually helping humanity. So I think it's something that we all have to really pay attention to and stand up for our rights in this regard. So this thing has to be repealed.
Yeah. It's going to be a tough uphill adventure.
Well, I think we could start by dumping Congress. Anyone who voted for it needs to be eliminated from office, is what I say. You know, I think we have to really start standing up for our own human rights and dignity and sovereignty. And the only way to do that is to get money out of politics and get politicians who are serving that out of office.
I agree with you.
But the question is how.
Yes. And it's a question also, the money is what gives them the visibility. And if you have whatever modes of communication, whether it's radio, whether it's television, or anything that you know, campaigning, those companies demand a lot of money, and it's basically the person with the fattest pockets gets the most the most exposure.
Well, I agree, but I think perhaps the time has come for a different kind of response. So, granted, this is a smallish media outlet, WBAI Pacifica, compared to the mega outlets that have media, but there's also the internet that has some access. But I think really we need to start talking to each other as human beings and devising a strategy. So for instance, if in any given campaign, whomever has the most ads should go to the bottom of our list of who we would vote for. So whoever's spending the most money doesn't get the vote. I mean, there are things that we can do. There just needs to be a campaign of educating beyond speaking to the converted, as it were. You know, mm-hmm. what does it say, preaching to the choir? Yeah. Like folks who are tuned in to WBAI probably get it. but there's a vast amount of people who don't get it. And
I think it's very important to dialogue with them.
That's what I'm saying. There really needs to be, so that it's not just this radio station, but people who are listening can do outreach and can reference the radio station, because it's available on the radio, it's available on the internet, and, you know, start building and sending information through websites, through Facebook. I think that we can begin to work with each other, starting with those of us who have an understanding, and rather than, as happens very often in an outlet such as this, people fight over control of the microphone. Oh, no, it's my idea that's important. No, it's my idea. When we should be working together and finding a way to shed light into a broader spectrum of people, because I think that there's many people who are frustrated and who understand the problem but give up because they don't see a solution. So maybe the thing is to start spreading the word about creating some of these solutions and looking and really looking at who we're voting for. Like, you know, I think I did vote for Obama the first time, but I think that was the last time that I'll ever vote for someone that doesn't truly have a track record that shows that what they're saying is real. You know, I don't think there's any percentage in voting for someone who's not capable of fulfilling their so-called promises. I think you have to look at what a person has done in their life.
I agree. And I think that in terms of matters that you were speaking about within BAI or Pacifica, I think it's important to go back to the original mission of the organization. It states it very clearly, about indulging or engaging in dialogue to really look at the differences and to come to a common understanding.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you focus on that rather than having the danger of mission creep, then a lot of your solutions will come to you if you just make sure that you understand what you're here for.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I think that's a big part of it. And I think many and most of the broadcasters here do have that in mind. And it's just that we each have a different passion and focus. But I am really thinking we need to find a way to broaden the message and to begin to interconnect and network with other people who are understanding this. Because it's not just in the big cities, there are people all across the country who are working in their way to make change happen.
And in many of those cities, there are Pacifica affiliate stations.
Exactly. So I think that there is possibility to build change and to change the world and to bring some of the real scientific information forward, like this information about the scalar energy or, you know, the free energy that's existing everywhere that just needs to be tapped. Because there are also a lot of scientists out there and a lot of builders and creators. And I think that there can be a way for people who have the skill set, people who have the ideas and wanting to support it, and there are going to be people who have the resources, the financial resources, who have integrity. You know, it's just a matter of finding those people from all of the different walks of life who care about the future to bring our resources together to begin to build alternative ways of being, getting off the grid, you know, building our own, you know, people who have farms, and why don't we support those farms instead of going to the supermarket buying food that's been shipped across country. You know, there's a lot of things we can do as individual people to change the world.
I know.
Yeah. So that's cool. We're just about out of time. We're going to make some room. Coming up will be Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund. And you've been listening to Heart of Mind, Earth at Midnight. I'm Catherine Davis. And
I'm Paulette Spencer.
And we played a lot of music. We told you about the earlier stuff. We also played Indigo Girls. What was that piece with Indigo Girls?
Galileo.
Galileo. And we heard, of course, The Bell for Freedom.
Yes.
By Stevie Wonder.
We also heard Shanghai Lily Dublin, which was Reflections of Your Ship.
And Skinny Dipping in the Moonlight.
To the Rocket Scientists.
Okay, and now we're going to hear, as we move into a transition, a piece called Pluto.
Yes, this is different genre. This is from the composer Gustav Holst from his suite, The Planets.
Beautiful. And I want to thank you, Paulette. Paulette has produced today's program. It's been a wonderful program. Thank you very much. And for those of you who tuned in last week, if you want to get a copy of those affirmations that we used in the show, send an email to heartofmindradio@gmail.com, heartofmindradio@gmail.com. And please do tune in next week. We're going to be going deeper into the whole concept of scalar energy, free energy, and tapping into the wisdom and the power of the cosmos.
Wow.
Should be good.
Should be great.
Stay tuned.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, aside from I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. Towards the end of the new film, Selfless, Ryan Reynolds, playing a fabulously wealthy real estate mogul whose consciousness has been placed into the body of Ryan Reynolds, corners the head of the evil corporation that performed the mind swap and calls him psychotic. It's the moment that most makes sense in the movie, because the only way a film can justify the kind of boneheaded behavior exhibited by this particular character, played by Matthew Good, is by labeling him crazy. In fact, the label needs to be applied to the entire corporation this guy runs, an operation whose bizarre business philosophy starts with lying to its affluent and presumably savvy clientele about the provenance of their spanking new bodies, which are not the lab-grown blanks they're supposed to be, but real people so financially desperate with Ryan Reynolds' buff physique mind, that they're willing to sell themselves to get out of their predicaments. That business philosophy then goes on to treat the brain swap procedure as somehow more secret than nuclear launch codes, so secret that clients are forced to take on new identities. Are people, even rich ones, that desperate for immortality? And so secret that this company, even infused with wads of cash from its well-heeled buyers, somehow finds it financially feasible to deploy an entire undercover army of security people and operatives on each and every client, presumably for life, on the off chance that one of them will have a change of heart and give the game away, and then reacting to any breach of security through the low-profile strategy of torching, literally, everything and everyone the client has come in contact with. By the way, with flamethrowers that for some reason are stored in the control room of their mind transfer facility. Honestly, it'd be more fascinating to see the story of this corporation's devolution. The level of compromise and self-deception involved in going from ambitious medical procedure to a company so evil that it sets a new paradigm for evil movie corporations has to be epic. We don't get that story, sadly. The story we do get, in which Ben Kingsley turns into Ryan Reynolds and then has to seek redemption by helping out the widow of his new body, played by Natalie Martinez, and her young daughter, isn't anything particularly remarkable. It is directed by Tarsem Singh, so everything looks great, particularly during the post-operation, pre-reckoning moments when Reynolds gets to live the good life. There are some cool camera moves and a car chase with a few neat surprises in it, but the notion of this corporation insinuating itself inextricably into its clients' lives is never played up enough to make the paranoia truly delicious. Reynolds never convinces as an aged soul in a 20-something's body, and Kingsley isn't particularly successful in setting up how the person he's playing will morph into Reynolds, and the really wretched attempt at a Brooklyn accent doesn't help. The film is classy-looking and dumb at base. And, by the way, the presentation you've seen of that title as self/less is, not surprisingly, point/less. So, let's stop talking about that and make a note of two more interesting films, both Asian, one that opened last weekend, one that's opening this weekend. At first blush, the Japanese film Jellyfish Eyes looks like someone tried to develop the ultimate family film while on a massive coke bender. The screenplay is an epic mashup of E.T., Pokemon, and the giant rubber monster films known as kaiju. The effects are elaborate, but also a little cheesy. There are plenty of explosions and energy beams and battle sequences, and the children who are the main cast are all adorable. But the director is actually Japanese artist Takashi Murakami, whose style, which he calls super flat, is meant to suggest a cross-fertilization between Japanese high and popular cultures. And as a result, you don't have to dig too deep to find undercurrents not usually present in commercial family fare, primarily among them that the events depicted take place in the aftermath of the Fukushima nuclear disaster. Murakami considers himself a disciple of Jeff Koons, so I guess some caution should be exercised. But the film plays so successfully with the blurring of lines between mainstream entertainment and delirious satire that it's hard not to enjoy the onslaught. Jellyfish Eyes is the film Jurassic World should have been. The other film, the one that's opening this weekend, isn't really science fiction or fantasy, but it's just too good not to make note of. The Korean film A Hard Day is the kind of twisted noir that that country has staked a claim to over the past few years, but pushed to the nth level. It concerns a corrupt homicide detective who accidentally runs over an innocent victim on the night of his mother's funeral, and in attempting to hide the crime, opens up a whole mess of trouble for himself that eventually involves drug running, nocturnal grave robbing, and cops even more corrupt than he is. It's only the second film directed by Kim Jong-un, but man, is it assured and suspenseful and violent and frequently very funny. I try not to make these reviews sound like shopper's guides. I don't think that's what film criticism should be, but I dug this film so much, I'll make an exception in this case. If you love Korean noir, or just film, frankly, A Hard Day is a thing you need to see. I'm Dan Persons. Remember, we are archiving these reviews over at my Mighty Movie Podcast website, so check out what you missed by going to mightymoviepodcast.com.
And thank you, Dan. Blah, blah, blah. Been working all day with my headphones on all day and didn't really fully properly prepare a show, but we have a good one for you nonetheless. Last week I was at ReaderCon while everybody was paying attention to Comic-Con, people who were dealing with less graphic materials and more prose-based stuff were in Burlington, Massachusetts, just outside of Boston, and having a wonderful time, may I say. And I spent pretty much all day Saturday, third day of the con, started Thursday, doing interviews. And because the con area was so filled, I went to the outdoor gazebo area. But the gazebo was constantly filled with people. Fine. Okay. I did about 5 interviews there. And I ended up with my first sunburn in years and years. I'm almost proud of it because I'm such an indoor person. You know, I'm wearing sort of my geeky heart on my sleeve that I don't get out enough to get a sunburn, but I did this time. And so I come back with a number of interviews, one of them tragically lost, and it was one of great.